Well, unfortunately, Braves country, we lost another great Brave. The Braves putting out a statement about Bob Horner. And Horner was the first overall pick in 1978. Skipped the entire minor league system. Mm-hmm. Made his debut directly in the majors. He was a hell of a player. And we've had this conversation with our buddy Dale Murphy, Mike, about what Horner was and the kind of competitor he was. He was Atlanta's first player to ever hit 4 home runs in a single game. And the Braves also state that, you know, he was the National League Rookie of the Year in 78 and then NL All-Star in 82. But him and Murph, man, in the 80s, early 80s, in the mid-80s, they were the guys.
Oh, as kids who grew up going to, you know, Fulton County Stadium, he was one of the most popular players. Remember, as a guy that went to watch the Braves as the visiting team at Shea, he was always a guy you wanted to see, just like Murph, you're right, man. And hit a home run in his first game, just a stud, right? You said, right out of Arizona State, right to the show.
Stud. So condolences going out, but man, it's been tough here. We were just talking about the patches and the things that the Braves are trying to do to honor those that we've lost. And, you know, I don't know if there's ever the right thing, but you kind of want to make a statement with what you're trying to, you know, the legend and remember of somebody and what they meant to the organization. We're talking about Bobby Cox, obviously. Right. Bob Horner, we were talking about Ted Turner. Mike and I were just having this conversation.
Yeah, because being at the ballpark and seeing the tiny six on the back of the hat, I just wanted a little bit more, you know, for Bobby Cox and more for Ted. But either way, in the case of Bob Horner, he was 68 years of age.
All right. Tough stuff, man. We have a lot going on today, guys. More news on James Pierce Jr. If you have not heard, stay there. We will get back into that story. It is a big deal for the Falcons as they continue to get ready for another round of OTAs. Coach is speaking tomorrow. We'll have it for you right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. But right now, we got to talk about what's going on around the SEC. Well, our guy Connor Riley is here. It's the spring meetings. I said that Greg Sankey is standing 10 toes down. He has, made a stance when it comes to where he's at with the college football playoff. I want to know when he said that they're committed to the SEC championship game because they have contracts. Was that tongue in cheek? I mean, because we know, Connor, these contracts don't mean anything. When they come up with these new ideas of expansion, stuff just goes away. Connor? All right, we'll grab him
apparently
in just a second.
The Big Ten doesn't want you to hear what Connor has to say.
I was going
to
say they've snatched
jamming the frequency. We'll get him back in just a second.
These spring meetings are going on down there in Destin, guys. They do it every year, but Sankey obviously is the first one to speak, and then we'll tell you what Kirby had to say as well as we'll get to Connor here in just a second. But he said they don't want to go away from the SEC championship game. Mike, we know if they go to 24, you can't do both.
Again, it's just you're going to be punishing yourself, and you're going to be on the road. The idea that, you know, you play in the SEC championship game, maybe pick up a third loss and find yourself having to go to, I don't know, Wisconsin. You know, that don't seem right either. But it just, it's a tradition. And because the SEC started it and it's become so successful over the 30 plus years, going all the way back to Legion Field, you know, Georgia Dome, Mercedes-Benz, it just feels bigger than all the other championship games combined. It just has.
No, it does. We'll ask Connor about that as well as what Kirby was talking about because is he there? All right, Connor, let's get back to it because I was asking the question about Greg Sankey saying the SEC championship game, they want to continue it. And I just said, he basically said, well, we have a contract. Is that enough?
I think it is. I think it's important to keep in mind that the SEC has a very strong relationship with ESPN. And when you look at, say, like the Big Ten and what they're possibly doing with their, you know, push for 2014 playoff, they've divided up their television revenue among CBS, NBC, Fox. ESPN runs everything when it comes to the SEC, and because they are so strong together, I think there is a desire to see that continue, to see that game continue. The reality is it also brings in a ton of money for the conference. It brings in consistently great viewership for the conference, where this past year, yes, the Big Ten championship game, I believe, had more television viewers, but that's because it was number one versus number two, and more often than not, that SEC championship game has been a de facto college football playoff game in terms of determining who gets into the college football playoff field and in recent years how it shakes out. So I think that the SEC understands that their championship game means a little bit more. I do that intentionally there. And I think because of that, they're not in a rush to see that game go away so long as we still sort of try and figure out what we want to do with the college football playoff and what that system and setup ultimately looks like.
It's funny because, you know, the argument for it, and they've talked about an article in the Chicago Sun-Times basically saying that they feel that the is ironic. They feel the College Football Playoff Committee, you know, doesn't really respect them, and they need to get locked in bids. Where you and I always argue, and Carl too, that, you know, the SEC's got the strongest schedule and the best, toughest atmospheres from top to bottom, and they don't seem to get the respect from the College Football Playoff Committee.
Right, and so ultimately, and I think that's where, even turning to today with what Kirby Smart had to say, there's real frustration, I think, from his perspective of how the College Football Playoff Committee views strength of schedule. And because that's what it is, and because that's how we've seen things play out, where that committee just counts the losses and says, oh, if you've got three, that's less than two, and the team with two is going to get in. And I think that there's real frustration there from the SEC, from Kirby Smart in particular, of that's not what's best for the sport. Like, we want to see teams go out and challenge each other, go out there and reward teams that play difficult schedules. And yes, you might have a loss or two along the way, but at the same point in time, you're also giving fans the type of thing that they want to see. And the reality is, this College Football Playoff Committee has not shown that to be rewarded. And I'm going to be super interested this year in seeing how the SEC is viewed and treated now that they are on a 9-game conference schedule, the same as the Big Ten, even though I think across the board, we would all agree that, one, the SEC is just a tougher conference top to bottom, and two, the SEC plays a considerably stronger non-conference schedule than the Big Ten does, and so I think that's important to factor in as well there as well.
Connor, help me understand what Kirby was saying today when he says, I've said this for a long time now to our president. I've been a huge advocate that if we can't find rules that everybody plays by, then we should play on our own. I'm not afraid of that. Is he in fact saying we would stand alone and do our own thing? Like, that's where he's at?
I think that's where the University of Georgia is. I think what Kirby said today really echoes what Jerry Moorhead said last week at Georgia's Spring Athletic Board meeting, where it's become abundantly clear Congress is not going to provide the relief that I think the heads of college football are looking for, which to anyone with a brain, I don't think is surprised by that. And so now you find yourselves in a spot where, okay, what does the SEC want to do here? And I think there is a desire from Georgia for the SEC to do what is best for the SEC, or do what they believe is best for the sport, and have the idea that everyone else will potentially follow along there. It's worth pointing out, as the people at Georgia do, that back during COVID, there was a lot of pushback to playing a college football season that year, and the SEC stood right firm, and they ended up playing that year. And I think everybody agrees in hindsight that was probably the correct decision that was made there. And I think ultimately, I think these conferences are going to have to make their own individual decisions there. Where my skepticism with some of this comes is, you look at some of the biggest offenders in terms of what they're spending on rosters, in terms of how they are circumventing the cap. A lot of those come within the SEC, your LSUs, your Texas A's, your Texas A&Ms in that regard. And I'm going to be curious to see, you know, Jerry Moorhead, when he was asked it last week, said that the conference is going to have a strong enforcement arm in that. Are schools like Ole Miss really going to subject themselves to that when they've been sort of skirting the laws as is, and it's led to a lot of success, as you saw with Ole Miss getting the college football playoff semifinals a year ago? It's one thing for me to hear Kirby Smart and Jerry Moorhead talk about breaking away, but until I see the rest of the SEC have a buy-in similar to that of what we've seen from Georgia, I am skeptical that that's ultimately going to happen.
I keep saying to you, and I talked to Mike Griffith from Dog Nation, like the old-school approach that Kirby uses as far as Georgia's business model. I saw that Jeff Santel had this article today about where the recruiting's at. Now, again, it's early, but May 26th, according to 24/7 Sports, Georgia's currently the 33rd best recruiting class. Rivals has them at 16. Jeff asks, what is going on with the 27 class? So what is going on with the 27 class?
Yeah, I think Georgia finds itself in a world where things are changing, where in the past you were able to every year sign a top five class. And that's what Georgia had done. They, for almost a decade, signed a top three recruiting class every single year. Because of the money and the way that that is tied up now, and the way that these rosters are constructed, the idea that you're going to go out there and sign the best class every year, or one of the three best class every year, I just don't know if that's the case anymore. You look at a team like Alabama, who signed a top five class last year. They're down in the 50s right now with the way that things are being set up. So I think that there are certain years where you're going to be able to spend a little bit more in recruiting, because on the back end, you have more coming off the books. And I'm sure that this economic talk is glazing over the eyes of the readers right now, or the listeners, excuse me. I do think that with Georgia, like, yeah, they're going to get guys that want to come play here. They're going to be top-rated recruits, because that's what Kirby sort of knows how to do. But the idea that they're going to get the best recruiting class every year, I think that's pretty clearly sailed. You saw that last year when they signed, I think, the number 6 overall class. And the reality is that's probably what Georgia's going to try and finish on a year-in, year-out basis now in that sort of 6, 7, 8 range as opposed to that 1, 2, 3 range every year.
Wow.
Yeah, but Connor, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you're competing for championships and you're in the playoff, I guess it doesn't matter. That just sounds weird. That sounds like I don't have to strive to be the or have the number one class anymore because that's not where it's at, right? We're just going to go get the guys we want to get, and wherever the chips fall, that's where they fall. Our fan base shouldn't be upset when they don't hear that we're top 3.
Right, and, you know, it's important to note, you know, for so much of Kirby Smart's time here, it was a 4-team playoff, and so you were incentivized to have a greater collection of talent because getting into the college football playoff was a lot of that more difficult. With 12 teams, the need, I think, to sign a top 3 class, regardless of how you feel about whether or not that's feasible, it has lessened a little bit where you've seen teams that haven't signed elite classes every year somewhat consistently get into the college football playoff. You've seen Indiana do that in back-to-back years, and they haven't sniffed a top 15 recruiting class there. So I think it's important to know, especially in the event that it expands to a 24-team college football playoff, to get into the playoff every year, which I think is the goal at a place like Georgia, you don't, I think, need those top classes anymore. And as we saw last year, you know, teams getting hot at the right time, a Miami team that right. came very close to winning a national title, an Ole Miss team. Those teams were not more talented than Georgia, but they were able to get the right break at the right time, something Georgia didn't get last season.
How much pressure on Kalen DeBoer? Because I saw him speaking today. Basically, he was asked the same question about what's the right number of a college football playoff, and he kind of equivocated, saying, for me, it's not really about a number. It's just trying to win every football game. So how many football games is Alabama going to win this year?
You know, he did sign a new contract this offseason. I think his buyout is like $67 million.
Oh.
And there's a part of me that's skeptical that it's going to be paid if things don't go well. But I do think that he is still under some pressure here, where, again, they don't need to win a national championship this year. They find themselves in a really tough place post-Nick Saban, where that first class, I think, was really wiped out by the transfer portal, and that put them in a hard place where, not dissimilar, I think, to where Georgia was a year ago. If they can sort of weather the year, maybe win a few games they shouldn't and get into the college football playoff at the end of the year, they're maybe better set up for a national championship run next year. But when you're Alabama and you've won as much as they've won, I don't think that the fan base is going to want to hear that. And if you lose games in the manner in which, like, Alabama lost last year, just getting absolutely blown out in the SEC championship game by Georgia and then losing again to Indiana in the Rose Bowl in a 38-3 beatdown, like, if you keep having those types right. of losses where it's not all that competitive, the temperature on Kalen DeBoer's seat is going to get very, very hot. And while he might not be fired this year, I think moves might be made to be put in place where it's going to be more difficult for Kalen DeBoer to get the resources he needs to win at the level he needs to.
So I say this all the time. What has he done? Like, who was coming to get Kalen DeBoer? And I get it. These coaches get raises based simply on the fact that there's a chance that somebody may call. But honestly, like, were they that – I'm talking about Alabama. Were they that afraid yep. that they wanted to do this kind of extension? That's a lot of money. You went from a little bit of money to a lot of money trying to get out of this deal, if you want to.
And look, the timing of it was Michigan after the Sharon Moore stuff, right. I think pretty clearly made a run at him. And the timing of that, where it would have been, I believe, mid to late December of them trying to go out there and find a coach if DeBoer had left for that Michigan job. I think the timing of that was something that Alabama felt hamstrung them. But I completely agree with you, Carl. Like, if Kalen DeBoer wants to leave at a place where Alabama, who's had more success than anyone,
yes.
who has shown that they're going to spend and do whatever it takes to win a national title.
Right.
And if that's not good enough for Kalen DeBoer, then Kalen DeBoer is probably not the right guy to lead your program.
Right. I mean, to pay that much. Here's a cookie for not going to Michigan. That's a hell of a cookie.
Yeah.
It's a big cookie.
Yeah.
Hey, Connor, before we let you go, I want to ask you this. The impact on the regular season. I know we've talked about this decision about, and by the way, Greg Sankey said he does not believe anything will be resolved at the spring meetings this week, even though they're going to talk about this mm-hmm. stuff. The impact on the regular season. Give me your outlook on that. As we know, this is probably going to happen. How does that affect the regular season of SEC football?
I'm going to be really interested this year with it being a 9-game schedule. And I think everyone clearly understanding now, as it's unfortunately been pushed here for a couple of years, like, the playoff just determines so much in terms of the way that the season goes. There's like a regular season loss staying in the same manner that it would have in years past. And even in a 12-team era, like, you think of the the Alabama loss in 24 for Georgia or the Ole Miss regular season loss that year. Like, there's a lot of unhappiness there. And I wonder, you know, and I think Georgia's going to win a lot of games this year. I think they're going to go 11-1, and I don't think 12-0 is off the table. But I think you also saw last year as well, you know, yes, Georgia plays big games, but games against like Kentucky just did not register in the way that I think they would have in the past. And so it's sort of like the big games are bigger than ever and they mean a lot more. But if it's not a big game, like the appetite is just not there at all from the fan base, mind you. And so I'm going to be really interested this year as we go another year into the 12-team playoff and we get a better understanding of what's in line. Like, Georgia's got a game against Missouri in mid-November. It's the last SEC home game, but as we say right now, unless Missouri has a really great season, which is going to be tough for them as they sort of work through what goes on with Ahmad Hardy, like, I don't know what the appetite for that Georgia game is going to be. If South Carolina's fired Shane Beamer at the end of the season when Georgia goes to visit there in September, right. You know, or in November, excuse me, what does that game look like from an interest standpoint? And I think that's where it really starts to hurt. It's like Georgia's game against Oklahoma, its game against Alabama, like, that's going to be huge. But like a home game against Auburn, a team that hasn't been very good lately, like, you wonder, that's where I think you really start to show the impact of an expanded college football playoff. And if it goes to 24, I think those non-big games feel even smaller, which I think is a real problem for the sport.
That's 100% right. I agree with you, man.
Yeah,
that's
a great way to put it. Connor, as always, tell the people where they can read your stuff, man.
Yep, you guys can follow me on Twitter at @KConnorRiley. Tomorrow we're going to get the game time announcements for Georgia's first three games of the season. So even though it's the middle of summer, we still got a ton of college football news coming out.
All right, great stuff. Again, appreciate you stopping by as the commission and all the coaches are down there for the spring meetings. Connor, have a great day, man. Appreciate you.
Yep, thanks, guys.
All right, coming up, is there a little bit more urgency maybe to bring in some more guys? We're really good, but are we going to go for it the way we should? We'll discuss as the Braves are on the road and a new series starts tonight. It's Dukes and Bell. When you're playing as good as our Braves are, you want to be all in. And hopefully, they are going to be all in. It's Dukes and Bell, Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Tonight, they start a new series with the Red Sox. And Mike, when you are offensively, okay, top five in almost every category, you're number one in a bunch of categories, right? But you're second in baseball and home runs hit behind the Yankees. You're first in batting average. Runners in scoring position. Like, these are things that win games. And so there's no surprise as to why the Braves are 36-18 and have the best record in baseball. Second in runs. But with all of that said, is there more pressure? And this is what you and I were talking about on Alex Anthopoulos with the way things have gone here first few months, right? Now we say, well, wait till we get the 1st of July. I don't need to. We got a good club. You got to make a decision on whether there's some urgency to bring in some more offense or pitching.
I honestly think right now, I mean, the idea and the story that broke last week when you're on vacay is that Schwellenbach and Waldrop are basically on the same schedule, and it sounds like they're ahead of schedule. And we'll ask Grant McCauley about it next hour at 5:20. We'll also talk about Bob Horner's legacy, guys, we learned earlier today. Braves posted information he passed at age 68. But yeah, I think it's more about a bat. I mean, you just scored five runs in the last three games.
Yep.
You know, 2-0, 2-1. There's been some where the bats have gotten cold. Now, Ozzy, I think, went for 3-4 the other night. He's batting like .207 for the month. Ozzy's cooled off a little bit. Albies, you know, we're so excited about where he's at. Consistency. You know, Maddox in a little bit of a lull and seems like he's okay. But it's just, I would definitely go and get another bat because even though Dubon has been clutch, he's cooled off too.
Yes.
You know, and I would think, yeah, whether you want to continue the platoon thing where Yaz only hits against right-handers. The other day he did deliver the goods a few weeks ago, but still, he's basically a guy you can't really have at the plate against a lefty. So I would definitely try to get a bat. And I do hope this year, and I'll ask Grant, you know, we always bust chops. Here it is, not even, you know, what? We just came off of Memorial Day. I'm looking for a trade. They're not going to do anything soon, but I would like to sort of beat the other guys to the punch, to your point. You know, so I know it's not going to come to July, you know, at the earliest, but I would love to see us, if it's an arms race, get ahead of everybody else. We're going to be maybe battling in October.
You know,
fire sale, it's fire.
No, that's
the opposite.
Not yet. But what's crazy is if we're able to reach the ultimate goal, which is the World Series, and by the way, I think. Okay, I know you guys are going, hey, it's way too early, you're crazy. I think we could be watching one of the best Braves teams that we've ever seen. No other Braves team has gotten off to a start like this.
But can they sustain it? Because of all the things we just talked about.
Well,
that's the question.
The length of the season always determines the greatness of the team. But for me to sit here and witness what I've seen, that no other Braves team has gotten off to this kind of start, even more talented Braves teams haven't done this. I think we're watching something that could ultimately be one of the best teams we've ever seen. The crazy thing for me is what I was going to say, Mike, is if we're able to accomplish this goal by staying in-house, it will be the most, I think, amazing thing about this whole story. You're telling me that at the end of the day, we started with four pitchers
right.
hurt, right, including Strider, who eventually comes back, and then you're telling me we're waiting on Swelly and you know, A.J. Smith-Shawver and these guys, and all these guys are going to come back and in some way, shape, or form help us, and we don't go outside to acquire more pitching, and yeah. we're able to win this thing. That's an incredible story.
I still think even with Waldrop and Schellenbach coming back, this goes back to you always seem to never have. Guys, let's talk about 2023. You came up short because you didn't have enough pitching. I got to get an insurance policy. I love the way they've set the bullpen up. Didier Fuentes can come in and shut it down for two or three innings. Suarez has been great. I still think he should be closing, but Iglesias is doing everything he needs to do when he came back from the injury. They're great. I mean, we got all these different pieces. It's not, you know, can it be as good as, you know, as what we had in 21 with the night shift? It's kind of trending that way. But maybe one more starting pitcher. How about that?
Okay. Well, look, I don't.
I mean, left fielder / another bat, starting pitcher. You never have enough help.
No.
In the pen.
And look, the way I think that Alex would probably go about this, Mike, would be an inexpensive bat, right? Just more help.
You know, again, can we ever take on a guy who has a contract? It's always going to be that dreaded expiring contract. You know how it works.
Well, yeah, because I think they're always thinking about the guys they have locked up. When you think about the guys that are still in the contract, even going into next year, Harris is here, right? Ozzie, they picked up the option this year, but Riley's locked up. Acuna's still under contract. Like, there's still a bunch of guys, and I don't know if that they want to do that. But either way, I still feel like there's some urgency now. Because we're off to this great start, and you cannot be first in baseball, Mike, heading to June and just kind of casually go, well, you know, we'll see where we're at. No. We've got a good club.
Yeah, I think it was Thursday or Friday, Grant posted that, talking with Spencer Schwellenbach, that he started throwing about seven or eight days ago, he started throwing.
Okay.
And he started, like, basically flat ground. They have a whole way they ramp it up at 60 feet. Then he's going to throw that distance for a couple of weeks, and they go to 75. But anyway, Schwellenbach and Waldrop apparently is almost on the same timeline. So that's really great news. But I still think while we're waiting.
And is that how they're looking at it? That they're getting two free agent pitchers?
Because Waldrop was one of the best young pitchers in baseball when the season ended. Yeah. So now we got to see how they approach it. That's great. Insurance policy. But again, it may coincide. These guys are back, and they'll have a sample size before the trade deadline.
It gives them a lot of flexibility if, in fact, they can come back and be successful. And, you know, I think the big thing is Strider looks starting to look like Strider, man. It's starting to feel a little bit better for me when I look at his stuff and how he's going about his starts. And Sale is just a dude. Like, that. We don't even have to talk about Chris Sale, but it's not going to be those guys. It's going to be this other part of the rotation that's got to uphold their part of the deal. 404-726-0929 as we talk about the Braves.
And by the way, just Bryce Elder, he did his job. Two earned runs.
He did.
One earned run, two runs are given up. Bryce Elder has been really good. Again, he has reinvented himself. You want to give Greg Maddux the assist for teaching him that sinker, whatever you want to do it.
Great.
The guy that I was complaining about, you can't trust him. You can trust him because he is now showing you he's learned how to, because he doesn't have blow away speed, to mix it up and really be effective.
Yeah. Braves, Red Sox tonight. We'll talk more about that particular matchup with Grant. But the fact that they've lost two series the entire season, is it real?
And you said, you know, starting the show, talking with Tony Gwynn Jr. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to win them all. You're not going to go 105, and well, maybe we could. But, I mean, the team looks really good. The pitching has been a tremendous surprise to Carl's point. It's just been, there's been some, look, you're going to have ups and downs for your hitters. It's just, Ozzie's kind of in one of those right now. We talked about Olson. Certainly, you know, I think, you know, Riley's found it. You know, I get guys complaining about Riley. I'm like, nah, he's getting better. The trajectory's there. Ronald's doing a great job, you know. Ronald's instant energy on the base pass.
He is.
It's just, you know, the thing that we've talked about.
The Baldwin injury concern you at all?
Yes, because you need to get him back. Because, I mean, look, and ironically, we had Chadwin Trapp give you the game winner the other night Friday. Yeah. Unfortunately, we just couldn't hit on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah,
strange not having the Braves in action on Memorial Day, wasn't it?
It was weird. Yesterday, I'm like, where are the Braves? And then I realized, oh, it's an off day. But it was kind of weird.
Right.
Man, you're right about Baldwin, and he's been so big for him all season long.
Hope he doesn't lose something in that break. You know, come back and, you know, has to go tweak the mechanics or something, because he was just so dialed in.
He was.
He seems like, I know that phrase called professional hitter, like a great ball striker, but the guy just looks so put together with a plan at the plate every at bat.
Couple of things before we get to guy talk. Tim Hires, he is our hitting coach, hitting instructor. He was asked a question about the secret of being a good hitting coach.
I've learned over the years you have to have patience. Number one, this game is very difficult. It's not easy, and you're going to go through those ups and downs, and you got to, you know, hang in there with players. They're not out there trying to make outs. They're working their butts off. And, you know, I think a big part is being patient with guys because you know they have talent, and that's part of it where I tell Darnell and Eddie, we just talk about we serve these players. Whatever they need, we're trying to serve them to help them be prepared for 7 o'clock and go out there and compete.
Well, they are, and the crazy thing is, again, first home series loss as they lost over the weekend, but again, I think when you look at the totality of the work that's been done, Hires deserves a lot of credit. We've talked about Walt Weiss deserves a lot of credit, but I also think whatever chemistry, Mike, that this makeup of this particular group has been very good. Here's Hires talking about Michael Money Harris.
He's an unreal talent. He really is. And so it's so fun to work with him and talk to him about hitting. But yeah, sometimes that is scary for a hitter to think about making a slight adjustment. But, you know, the adjustment he made, you know, kind of maybe raising his hands just a little bit higher, but was something he did when he first started minor league baseball and hit in high school. So it wasn't a major adjustment, but it's still scary. But credit to him, he worked through some difficult times, and then he's reaped the rewards of that hard work.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Mm. Hopefully they can keep things going. Strider's on the hill tonight. We'll talk more about that with Grant coming up.
The only thing that we talked about with Tony Gwynn Jr., I was asking about, you know, stolen bases. For all the things, you know, again, we may be leading the major leagues in pickoffs, being picked off, but the Braves are only 23rd in stolen bases right now. And we talked about how, let's be honest, you know, they were going to be more aggressive on the base pass. I think Walt had to back that off because our first base coach was like, you know, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, sending these guys.
Yeah, trying to go. The pickoffs have not been – we were trending in the wrong direction.
Yes.
Mike, what do we have coming up in Guy Talk?
Hey, man, some talk from Indy. If you missed it, Carl had a nice perk on his vacation. I got the Indy 500. It was the best and the closest finish ever in the history of the race. I got some stuff on that. And some of the things that I want to run by you since you were out of town last week, the whole Kyle Busch thing just blindsided us on Thursday at the end of the program. We'll talk about that because more and more information now coming out and how he was given tribute both in Indy and in Charlotte. We'll get into that. Come up with Guy Talk next on Dukes and Bell. Yeah, man. Carl and I, the band, back together. So happy, happy that you're back. Yeah, man. Warren was laughing. I was like... Abe, you know, very intense, very intense. Yeah, there's some things that you and I will talk, you know, in shorthand, and just, you know, there'll be levity and brevity, and something Abe just won't. He'll fight you. He'll fight you at every point. point, right? Am I lying? I'm not lying. No, and he's really, really great to work with. But you know, it's just nice to have you back. Thank you. I literally, Carl came back and was like, "Thank you, you're back."
He did say that today, and I was like, "What happened?" No,
it's just Abe. Will you just come with me on this one? Will you just roll with me? Anyway, over the week, and we saw tributes to Kyle Busch. We were just getting off the air on Thursday. By the way, thanks to everyone who showed up at Metro Bottle. Great turnout at Marietta Boulevard, getting ready for Memorial Day weekend, get the booze. The El Mayor tequila. We all show. I'm like, come on, Abe, do a little shot. It's not even a full shot. It's a tiny little shot.
A little shot.
Okay. You know, so we got it.
Finally had one.
If only we could get do
did
it.
Did he loosen up?
Well, if I want to do it at 2 o'clock. I mean, if you did it at 5:30, it would change the vibe of the show. But anyway, now thanks to everyone who showed up. And then as things were wrapping up, we got this news. And, you know, sometimes things hit you and you're just like, what? And that Kyle Busch had passed, only 41. By now, you know the details. And you and I were talking about this off the air. You know, the idea that, you know, he had sepsis after falling ill with pneumonia. I think... there's so many guys. I was talking to folks at the race at Indianapolis, you know, a guy like, I didn't know that was, you know, people not knowing how this works. And my first reaction, and I know we live in a litigious society, but my first reaction was like, how the hospital not catch this, you know, when he went home?
So what's interesting to me, and again, I'm sure there'll be more reporting on this, but when he felt ill, and you've now heard the recording in the car, it was the week before.
Right.
And he says, you know, get the doctor. I want to see him when the race is over.
He's shot. Yeah.
At that point, he should have been admitted. And what happened was the pneumonia is causing all these other problems, which lead. And Mike, once you start spiraling downhill, unfortunately, this is what happened to my father. Right. This is how it happened. It was a acute case of pneumonia. It's not a big deal. You know, we're going to take care of it. And it just slowly progressed, and it got to this point where Kyle Busch was, which septus, and then your organ failure,
Right. Your body shuts down.
And it's done.
Right.
Right.
I had a neighbor just deal with that a few weeks ago. She spent a week in the hospital down on the south side because it's just something. And again, like, I get it. And like, if an athlete feels bulletproof and, you know, but a guy with all the resources that Kyle Busch has, I'm curious to see how this goes, because all I can think of is be a lot of cover your ass.
Now,
if you're in the hospital, because how do you get sent home and what were the circumstances?
And then the other thing is, too, we talk about this with other sports, where sometimes you have to protect the player from himself. Was there anybody in his circle say, Kyle, you're spitting up blood?
Yeah, what the hell?
You know, you got this unusual cough going on, man. We got to get you to the hospital and admitted and get the proper test ran. I don't know. Maybe Kyle Busch is like, I'm fine. I'm going to continue to do what I do. Either way, man, it's tragic. And Mike, you're right. It hit the sports world hard because of his age, but more importantly, you know, the competitor he was, and it just resonates differently when you go, wait, what?
Right. And apparently 350,000 people die from it. And I mean, we always try to look for some kind of thing that can be a positive out of a tragedy is, I guess, like, we have a lot of guys out there that are all macho alpha types. And like, I know it was funny. I was talking about this with Brian, our buddy from New Orleans last week. You know, you go to the hospital when you're dead. You know, we grew up in a generation, you just don't go to the hospital. You don't go to the doctor. So hopefully more people will be self-aware of what's going on. Daniel Suarez wins the race, which is kind of touching and poignant because he did drive for Kyle Busch. And he paid tribute to his brother out there, taking a knee, laying flowers at his number in the infield. It was just goosebump stuff. But, you know, he was kind of known as, you know, a bit prickly at times, but everybody coming out and saying the softer side to this guy. I don't know if you've seen the video, Oren, where it's from a couple of years ago where he's in traffic in Charlotte and somebody's wearing a Kyle Busch hat and he's in traffic. And I think his wife's videoing on the phone. He goes, hey, how's it going? And the person looks over, oh, my God, it's Kyle Busch. It was just really sweet.
That's
so
cool.
Just so unbelievable at age 41. Real quick, I was at the Indy 500 over the weekend, and he raced the number 18 back in the day. So on lap 18, the pylon is all digital where you have all the rankings of the cars and everything. And they had a big tribute with his face and the showing, you know, his date of birth and everything. Just, same thing, Goosebump City. Everybody's like, wow, that's just, ugh. Anyway, it's just something we didn't get a chance to really react to because it was just sort of like, whoa, right at the end of the show on Thursday. Speaking of Indy, you talked about, if you missed it, Carl goes on a vacay. Not going to say specifically where, but talk about attentive customer service, talking to people about an anniversary. Oh, yeah, you on your anniversary, and then next thing you know, you're getting comped up the yin-yang.
Yeah, it was crazy. And we never said that it was. I just felt like whoever was listening in on our conversation literally was like, new arrivals, table 6, that's their anniversary.
And by the way, I got to be honest, you know, Becky's listening. She's like, she just texted me. She heard that conversation. She's like, we should have pulled that at Cabo. Hell yeah, we should have pulled that at Nobu for what we were paying.
I'm telling you, it was crazy. I felt guilty for a second until he, bring me more. But no, Mike, fun times, man. And, you know, I am a little darker. Can you tell?
Yeah, man, you got a nice
tone.
Can get some color. I just, and by the way, since we're talking about preventative medicine with what happened to Busch, I've always been the man who tans. You know, I've tried to take care of stuff. I got some stuff. I got to get zapped on my noggin this week.
Yeah.
So again, more suntan. Put this stuff down.
Take time. You know?
That was the famous story of the year we were up at Talladega, and our boy Brian, who happens to be African American, started putting some suntan lotion on. He looked back and goes, if I'm doing this, y'all need this.
You need to do it. I'm telling you.
You get some seriously bad sunburns at a NASCAR race.
When I meet people on vacay like that, I always tell them, they're like, man, you have a lot of suntan lotion on. I go, yes, I used to look like you. And they just die. You know, at that point, they're like, oh. But it's the truth, man. Look, it can happen to anybody. Skin cancer is real.
Oof, so take care of it, man. So you were talking about getting a nice comp. I was talking to the guy that owns the house we were renting for the Airbnb, because we went to this big, we went for the gusto on this one. I rented a house last year that's in like the Buckhead neighborhood sort of Indy called Broad Ripple, which is cool. It had a cool little bar as you can walk around. And it had two cool bedrooms, a couch. I took the pull-out couch, and we put my buddy in the basement bedroom that literally looked like something from Jamie Gumm, the home in Silence of the Lambs. Put the lotion in the basket! It was just, you know, I said, this year, I'm not going to monkey around.
Yeah,
so I showed Carl. I literally rented, I mean, it's a freaking mansion. And the guys all chipped in. The house I rented was built in 1901. So I'm talking to the guy, I'm in Hartsfield, you know, I'm catching the flight. And the guy goes, hey, what time you get in? I said, you know, I land at 10:30. Wasn't supposed to check into the house till 2. He goes, you know what? Just come to the house. We'll get you set up.
Oh, nice.
So nice. Now I don't have to like do nothing for 3 hours, right?
And that always helps.
So the house, apparently John Dillinger slept there, the former public enemy number one. And it might have been a house of ill repute at some point during the Depression when the guy who built it went bankrupt and apparently had to rent it out.
Fascinating story.
Yes. So, no, there was no hidden gold. It wasn't like Al Capone's vault.
Yeah, where you something in the wall.
Right. And so the guy's like, yeah, some people say it's haunted. I'm like, well, first of all, I don't believe in that crap. But it was but it was creaky. You know, every time you take a step, there's a creak. You know, it was a lot of antiques. It was really neat. Big backyard out in the back. It was Mac Daddy. So a really, really cool spot. The race itself, we invented something. Pictures are up. Again, I'm Mike Bell ATL. I got the old tag back. You can find me. I still don't have got my followers back, but I'm back on Twitter. We invented a new concept. I want to run this by you.
All right.
So you really can't do this on a major street or a thoroughfare. Like, you couldn't probably pull this off on 75, 85, trying to get to some sporting event. But because you take the back roads to get to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you go through these little residential areas in the town of Speedway, Indiana. And so it's just back bumper-to-bumper traffic. It takes an hour to get anywhere, to get to where we're parked. So we said, well, hell, man, the cooler's in the back. Tommy, pop the trunk. So we call it now, it's the strolling tailgate. So the driver is driving the car, and you walk or just stop when the car's not moving and drink your beers.
Okay.
What do you think? I'm just saying. I'm not saying I'm going to make
traffic
it.
Traffic was moving at a snail's pace.
And then I could then walk up and say, okay, oh, we're totally effed here. We're not going to make it the turn forever. No, I mean, the state troopers do a really good job of getting people out of the race. It's just getting to the race that is a bit much. But anyway, I'm glad I went.
Yeah, but it's what, 300,000?
Yeah, it's 350. They said it was about 345,000 people this year. Yeah. It's the single largest single event in the world of sports, in the planet, at any in all the things that go on, bigger than anything else.
Yeah, and think about we get mad when they got 65,000 down at Mercedes.
Oh yeah, I mean, the funny part is, just I'll fast forward to the leaving part. So we beat the rain. There was 100% chance of rain. They had a red flag it a few times, but at the end of the day, they got the race in. The greatest, closest finish. Felix Rosenquist beats David Malukas to the finish line by 0.02 of a second. It was fantastic. And the crowd, it's the team at Meyer Shank. It's a smaller team. And they won 2 Indy 500s. One with Helio Castroneves a couple years back. They're going bananas. Crowd was going nuts. But after the race, you're not going anywhere. So my buddy Tommy's like, well, it's going to rain. We'll pop the tent up. Foop. Put the tent. Crack, you know, get the chairs out, sit on the tent.
Wait.
And we watched the guy in a BMW not move for an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah, wait it out.
Finally, there was some other dudes. We met this guy. He's like, hey, man. He goes, you guys are having fun. Can I have a beer? And I said, that's poor planning on yours. Now, we've all been there. It's poor planning. That's why we always leave a half a case of beer in the car in another cooler.
Just in case.
And you take, and my back, I was like Quasimodo. I was humping 36 cans of beer in this big Coleman. But they let you know about you bring beer in. The funny part was the British guys were going into the track. And this guy, he's fascinated. He goes, let me get this straight. He goes, you can bring alcohol into this. Yes. Yes. He goes, you can bring to the race. I go, yes, we can do this in NASCAR races too.
Yeah.
He goes, you can make sandwiches. You can make, you can
bring what you need.
You can make a burger on your grill, put it in tinfoil, take it aside. He goes, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I go, yes, it's what we do. So this guy's like, is beer expensive? Here I go, it's not cheap.
Not inside.
But anyway, it's just kind of neat. We met some friends from all over the world. One thing they did, and I've told Carl this story every year I go. Every year I'm like, you know, this is probably the last year I'm going to go. This is my 28th Indy 500. And then I saw history, so I'm glad I went. But this year, Carl, they did it for the second year in a row. They play taps. So you got 345,000 plus people at total silence and attention for taps as you play, because it's Memorial Day. We're thinking of the soldiers and the men and women who gave their lives for the U.S. And so that's Goosebump City. Then they do the anthem. Then they get the flyover. The F-18s come zooming in, or F-16s. It was bananas. Then you had the two Black Hawk helicopters following the pace car all around the track. Mm. Literally, you got these helicopters, maybe 50, anybody who served in the military, you know what kind of propeller wash is like. All of a sudden, it was wild, man. So right over our heads. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. It was great.
Yeah, the buildup, the pomp and circumstance, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
It really is. I've always said to folks, so my buddy Brian, it was funny, somebody saw some photos I posted, like, why are you partying with a New Orleans Saints fan? Well, he has to wear the Saints hat, because he's my friend, okay?
Yeah.
We can be friends with Saints fans, okay?
I know it's rare.
I know. We had fun. Brian was, he was blown away to stand, because we had really great seats. He could walk down and stand right next to the track, and security was being cool, and just foom, 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 you know, at 240 miles an hour zipping by, man. Anyway, Felix Rosenquist wins the race. In case you're wondering, he wins over $4 million for winning the race.
By the way, those prize packs, they've gone up, Mike.
This is a good time. So, you guys, I know we're in NASCAR country, and I love Formula One. Formula One also had a really exciting race up in Montreal. Boo on Liberty Media for running the same day as, you know, Indy 500, although a few hours later. But Felix Rosenquist wins $4 million. He gets the Corvette pace car, gets a tag, new watch, and he gets a diamond ring for being the champion.
That's sweet.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And then as soon as he's cooling down on the cool down lap, his wife had just had a baby back in Sweden. So he's like, wish my wife was here. Everybody's like, you know, it was good times, man. It was cool. So anybody else, if you ever want to go up to Indy and you need some information or just, you know, a little bit of, you know, hints on what you can do, just hit me up at Mike Bell, ATL on Twitter, and I'll hook you up. I told Carl, man, would you eat good, by the way? What was the best meal you had down there on vacation?
So we actually had, I told you it was a snazzy resort. We had a we had an 8-course.
Giddy up. I like, you had me at 8-course.
Yeah, eight, I want to say it was 8. Mike, it might have been 10. It was unbelievable. Where this world-renowned chef prepared each portion. And it was, I'm having a hard time describing it.
So varying all sorts of different styles and genres of food?
Of different foods, but yes, but this was his style. I got the guy's name because we talked to him, and he's a world-renowned chef. But like, you know, Michelin 5-star kind of deal. It was unbelievable, but it was extra. But that was included because it was our anniversary.
Nice. Very nice. So that's awesome, man. No, so again, we had a ball. By the way, we were watching my buddy Tommy played.
It really wasn't, by the way.
My buddy played college basketball for University of Buffalo. Now, I guess they're in the MAC now. So Big Tom, you met Big Tom, 6'8" guy, played center. Anyway, we're watching basketball. We're watching the Wemby thing. And literally, you know, you're renting a house, so you don't want to spill or anything. And we literally, his son, when Wemby hits that half-court shot, literally, the beer goes flying. It was like, oh, my God! It knocks over beer. Like, oh, God! You know, it's antiques everywhere. This house is like gazillions of, oh, God, get the towels out quick. But that was one of those moments why you watch sports to see in that series. Again, the Knicks are already clinched, and they've won everything, and now they're going to wait again. But we said earlier, we'll talk about it next hour. You got to feel some sense, I guess, some sense of pride that maybe we stirred the Hawks stirred the Knicks on, or at least we're the only team to beat these guys this year in the playoffs.
Yeah, they've won, 11? I think it's 11 or 9 straight, something of that nature in these playoffs. It's been crazy. The last team that did that was Golden State in 2017, where they didn't lose a game. You know, I think it was like 14 in a row or something crazy.
The other thing is, and by the way, we'll talk more. We can get into this more tomorrow. It's kind of funny because the Knicks are going to be cooling their jets now for a while.
Yeah, they are.
There's a meme that's out there that talks about all the things that didn't exist in 1999. Including your smartphone, and you can just take it from there.
Oh, no doubt.
But all the things that didn't exist the last time. And by the way, the Knicks were an 8 seed that year, and that was a strike-shortened year.
Yeah, and Spurs won it.
Yes, they
Duncan
did.
Duncan and Robinson.
In 5.
And Avery Johnson. All right, coming up, we are going to talk about the system in place that's going to benefit the two guys that need it most. It's Dukes and Bell.